I do have to ask you, since I have you here, last year you've given us some teases about the Winds of Winter, but last year you dropped the bomb that you had a twist that you were contemplating, but you weren't sure if you were going to go ahead with it. Can you tell us if you've decided and if we'll know what it is when we eventually read it?
I have decided to do that, yes.
How's it going? How's the process of becoming Sullied?
It's good. I'm about halfway through Feast for Crows, loving it. Really excited for all of the surprises that await. And you've recently completed Dance with Dragons, right?
There are some serious feelings.
Well, our Feast with Dragons reading order gives us unique opportunities, and one of them is to very expertly supplant the Hunter and the Hunted here in this episode for your listening pleasure.
So, Hannah, Micah, the two of us who have been among the Sullied for the longest, our friend Terry Schwartz recently interviewed George R. R. Martin. We just listened to it. Mm-hmm. How do you feel?
Well, I feel like anytime you get new information, it's a good thing. And I'd just like to say that Terry did an amazing job in this interview for IGN, which listeners can go ahead and watch over on Watchers. It's about 30 minutes long, and it really chronicles a lot of the writing history of George R. R. Martin. But she, of course, saved the best for last with her question about a twist, something that George had mentioned last year about a character who is no longer alive in the show, but is very much alive in the books. And unfortunately for us, as he mentions, that's about 15 or so characters. So there's definitely a lot of debate as to who that character could be. And in fact, he mentions it's something that involves a couple of characters, one of whom happens to be dead. So let the speculation begin. I wonder, and I'm going to throw the question out there now to the group, who do you all think this could possibly be about?
Could be anybody.
Eerie.
I'm glad he's going ahead with it, honestly. Like, he hinted at it previously, but he's decided to go ahead. I'm glad that, decisions are clearly being made as it pertains to the next book, which is all I want to hear. I don't want to hear more indecision coming from him, like, I wasn't sure, it's this, the other thing. No, like, he spoke so candidly about it. He offered up the information that the character was alive in the books but dead on the show. I'd say He's absolutely answered. He handled the question very nicely.
Who was your gut reaction of who you thought he was talking about? Because I had the name immediately pop in my head, and I don't know if it's right or wrong, but
could it be Gren?
My mind went to Stannis, the one true Manus.
That's exactly what I thought too.
He wasn't the first person that came to mind to me, though. Certainly knowing the fact that he is very much alive in the books, but not so much anymore in the show, thanks to Brienne. I think that he could certainly be in a top five.
Let me set the scene for you. Exterior, Winterfell, day. Stannis the Manus, spared by Brienne of Tarth. This is the beginning of Brienne's second buddy cop thriller. Spent time with Jaime Lannister. Now it's time to spend time with Stannis, the one true Manus. Will they bathe? You bet your sweet ass they will.
Will you please write this fan fiction?
I want
that.
Yeah,
I do. Oh, wait. I mean, what?
I want that.
No, but Stannis is my initial thought, too.
Think about the possibilities. Remember how Jaime Lannister changed in our minds?
Yeah. Stannis should just teach. It should be like a one-room schoolhouse with Stannis as the teacher for English grammar.
You know how much time we've spent with him? And Melisandre and Davos.
Right.
I don't need to tell you about the history. More time than we spent with Jaime before his redemption.
Is she like the fairy that goes around and turns everybody into good people? Is that what you're trying to say?
Or at least through her eyes or the proximity of her eyeballs, we can learn the truths of some people. Because she is so unabashedly herself, and it's such a breath of fresh air in a book filled with political angst. She's just herself. She's the Maid of Tarth with a horse face. With straw hair that's brittle, unapologetically badass, and I love it. And this was our first ever chapter with her today through her point of view. And it's just like, come on. Brienne is so likable. She's so energetic. She's a bit she's knocking a little thick on some points in this chapter, but it's fine because she's, you know, what she's been charged to do is kind of a big deal. The person who possibly was involved with murdering the king.
The character that first really came to mind for me, to be honest with you, is Barristan Selmy. I just think that his death was very underwhelming in the show. And another character that I actually saw talked about a lot on the message boards and on social media when this interview was first released was Jane Westerling.
Right.
We know that she is somebody who is a point of view character, at least if we are to believe what George says for the purposes of the prologue. And actually, we probably hope that she's just a character that is in the prologue, not the actual point of view character, because we all know
she's
well.
Probably going to die.
She's somebody, of course, Lady Talisa in the show, who dies, but we know is going to serve a purpose in the books. So those are kind of my top two, I would say. Barristan Selmy and Jane Westerling.
I'm pretty sure she's going to be giving birth.
A very close third. So I actually think here we have a top five. Is it fair to say that we have a top five?
Well, Gren. I'm still thinking Gren.
Shireen.
Oh, Shireen.
Yeah.
And a certain presence at Castle Black, or at least in the north.
Yeah.
The Lord of Bones died in the show.
Mance Rayder.
Yeah, so did Mance Rayder.
So there's a possibility there.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. But isn't it fun that we can have these conversations at this point? I feel like this is the teaser campaign for Winds of Winter on accident. And Terry's interview has really gained a lot of excitement for people. The community has been pretty receptive. I saw it trending all over the world, and that's pretty cool for a book.
What if he's talking about Jon Snow? I'll be so annoyed.
That's just not cool.
I won't be. That's
right?
Great.
I'd be so annoyed if he's talking about Jon Snow.
Feel free to write in.
Definitely.
What are your theories? What does all this mean?
Mm-hmm.
Don't know.
I'm looking for a maid of 3 and 10, she told the gray-haired goodwife beside the village well. A high-born maid and very beautiful, with blue eyes and auburn hair. She may have been traveling with a portly knight of 40 years, or perhaps with a fool. Have you seen her?
That was our transition into Brienne's chapter.
One of the really interesting things I found about Brienne's point of view is that once you're actually inside of her head, she's not in any real way different from the way that she's
Brienne's
perceived
chapter.
By others. And I thought that was very different from, let's say, Jaime. Jaime is somebody who we all do a complete 180 on as we continue to read the series, and a lot of times his who he is perceived to be by others is not, in fact, who he is at his core. Sure, he's done some terrible things. He threw Bran out of a window. But when you get inside the mind of Brienne, she's very much what you have come to know her as and what you anticipate her to be. And I think that that is refreshing in a way.
In this chapter, we're in her head. She gets called wench and her nose crinkles. It's like, but you have like the thought process behind it of that sucks. That's disrespectful. And then when the guy calls her woman, she's like, okay, that's slightly less disrespectful, but I'd just as soon be called sir or knight. You know, so it's like it's really just Jamie might have been extra perceptive, and that's why, you know, we feel like it's the same Brienne we've already known. But essentially, I would just agree that they're very much the same. Like she has this honest disposition, or it's impossible for her to be, I guess, altogether deceitful or
too
deceptive
crafty.
Or hidden. Yeah, she's not trusting. That's the wrong word for it, but like she really does wear her mission on her sleeve.
That was the point I was getting at earlier, Eric, was that she was so unapologetically herself.
Yeah. I mean, she's going door to door, for Christ's sake, like in Westeros from King's Landing looking for Sansa Stark. Like every single person she encounters on the road, she recites the
where do whores go?
But less mania. Yeah, I'm looking for a maid of 3 and 10. She tells everybody, and I love when she gets called out on her shit, because it's just like, hello, you need to think about this a little bit further. But Brienne is ultimately a good person, and she may be. I mean, she still has a little ways to learn, apparently.
But I really like that about her, that she's still the same person that we've come to love, especially as we see what she just goes through on a day-to-day basis and like how people speak with her right. and how she continues to be who she is and continues to be who she wants to be regardless of what people say to her or how they may make her feel. And she continues on this quest because she's got this nobility about her, which I think is really great.
Yeah, she's duty bound.
You're going to protect a Stark with Ned's own steel.
Well, so cool.
And that's really the coolest thing is for all her protection that she's got because she's a badass, she's also got a Valyrian steel sword. She's got this letter from the king, which luckily enough is the current king. You know, kings change so often. I'm surprised that the letter that was signed 2 weeks ago is still the same king.
She's
but
got
it
a lot
is.
Of gold.
It's Tommen.
King Tommen. Tommen's, the first of his name, but, signed in crayon.
He stamped it. He loved it. It's the best part of his day.
It's his favorite part.
She's
yeah.
got a small sack of golden dragons. She's got just a healthy sack of silver stags.
But
that's
even
what I'm
then,
she's got all the money that she could hope for.
But even then, she still doesn't. This is a little bit more near the end of the chapter. But even then, she still doesn't feel like she's worthy of this task. And she feels, you know, in the beginning, she kind of talks about how, oh, maybe Jamie sent me on this as like a joke. You know, maybe he didn't think I could do this. And then at the end, it's kind of like she's like, well, maybe I can't do it. Like, you know, here's all the other people that I failed and blah blah blah. Maybe I'm not a hero. But she is literally on a hero's journey. And she's,
literally.
Like we've been saying, she has this cool sword and she has lots of money. She's best friends with Jaime Lannister. Like, she could take any yeah. of these people on the road out in 5 seconds. But she still,
definitely.
Like, has this doubt in the back of her mind that is too bad.
That's what's great about this story that George has constantly drove into us and we've constantly brought up on the podcast. And it's just very clear the more we go through the story, these heroic and faded times that we're, air quotes, living in are just as cool as the times we've heard about in the past. And she is friends with Jaime Lannister, and she is going to save someone that's part of a family that's probably going to be very crucial in the way that this world ends up shaping when the stuff starts going down, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And here she is, this person that's so unique in her own stead, from Tarth. If I fear the likes of these, I had as well swap my longsword for a pair of knitting needles.
I love that line.
And then there's that line, she had promised Lady Catelyn that she would bring back her daughters, and no promise was as solemn as one sworn to the dead. I just thought that was so eerie.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with the place that we go in the next chapter, but...
Very eerie.
In both of these chapters, as it relates to... the Starks. We are constantly reminded of the fact that all of these Starks are dead, right? Brienne is in search of Sansa, who she believes to really be the last living member of the Stark family. And Lady Catelyn is dead, not true. Bran and Rickon, mentioned in the next chapter with Sansa, are said to be dead, not true. So it's really
it's probably
funny
better
that
for them.
I don't know. Is it like subliminal messaging that's going on here where they're trying to convince us that the Starks are really dead when in fact they're really not? Arya is made mention of in this chapter, the fact that the fake Arya got married off. It says in the next line, the younger girl was long dead, Jaime claimed. The Arya the Lannister sent north to marry Roose Bolton's bastard was a fraud. That left only Sansa.
Right.
Brienne had to find her.
Definitely with Bran and Rickon in the Sansa chapter, I was like, but wait a minute, because you just get this in your head that there's so few Starks out there. But if you count Jon, there's still 5 of them. So it's pretty impressive. But Arya's just managed to keep such a low profile. And like in contrast, at least more people have always been talking about Sansa. I think it's because she was trapped in King's Landing, obviously, and wed to the Lannisters. Obviously, and her role in the death of the king. But like Brienne on her way out of King's Landing, when she's kind of surveying her options, in truth, Sansa could be anywhere. But ultimately, Brienne has decided to make a few decisions about what is the course of action that she's going to take. She's heading to Duskendale, and I'm pretty sure it's because the people at the on the Blackwater that she spoke with, where the ships were anchored, said that there was trade in Duskendale and that some of the ships that left port here the night of were heading there. And it's just like the tiniest little wisp of a possible direction when in truth, you know, we know that Sansa got on sort of a privately chartered vessel and wasn't heading there at all. But she's got to start somewhere.
If I were a maiden newly flowered, alone and afraid, in desperate danger, what would I do? She had asked herself. Where would I go? For her, the answer came easy. She would make her way back to Tarth, to her father. Sansa's father had been beheaded. Whilst she watched, however, her lady mother was dead too, murdered at the Twins. Here's a little bit of just context for everyone. And Winterfell, the great Stark stronghold, had been sacked and burned, its people put to the sword. She has no home to run to, no father, no mother, no brothers. She might be in the next town or on a ship to a Shai. One seemed as likely as the other. Even if Sansa Stark had wanted to go home, how would she get there? The King's Road was not safe. Even a child would know that. The Ironborn held Moat Cailin athwart the neck, and at the Twins sat the Freys, who had murdered Sansa's brother and Lady Mother. The girl could go by sea if she had the coin, but the harbor at King's Landing was still in ruins, the river a jumble of broken quays and burned and sunken galleys. Brienne had asked along the docks, but no one could remember a ship leaving on the night Joffrey died. A few trading ships were anchoring in the bay and offloading by boat, one man told her, but more continuing up the coast to Duskendale, where the port was busier than ever. Sort of an upswing.
Literally a needle in a haystack, which is kind of a cliche.
But she's got to pick somewhere to go, and yeah, she picks Duskendale. She picks one. She doesn't have that trouble that I think, like, she's not, if she questions her mission, it's while she's on the road to somewhere. Mm-hmm. There's that forward momentum there, which I think is really important.
I think it's interesting that she goes around asking, have you seen a highborn maiden with auburn hair? You know, thinking about would Sansa really be traveling as herself? And I think that this is Brienne probably covering all of her bases as she continues to move through the countryside. But I thought that that was interesting that that was something that she's done, figuring that Sansa probably wouldn't be wandering out in the open. But maybe she would be. I mean, I don't know.
She does get a bit of a reality check from Shadrick later on in the chapter when he's like, hey, I'm looking for Sansa Stark too. Do you want to split the ransom? And I think she kind of... I'm glad that it happens in her first chapter in A Feast for Crows, and not a few. You know, when she like suddenly realizes later on that maybe this isn't the best way to go about this very important task.
And maybe I should hurry up before. Yeah, maybe. Well, not that she can hurry up any faster. I mean, she's doing the best she can, but there's other people on the road.
How did this chapter make you guys feel? Like, Micah, how did this make you feel? How did listeners at home, how did this make you feel? Guys, how did this make you feel? Does it, because for me, I thought, you know, knowing how she flows through the rest of this particular book, not our combined story, I was just really happy with feeling this kind of storyline come out of A Song of Ice and Fire, because it's, like you guys said, not overtly action-packed, but it does a lot to expose the world and the country that we're living in. And to that, the chapters that are nearby, these chapters, get so much benefit from the world building and from the point of view that Brienne has on the world.
I would agree with that completely.
It reminds me of Arya and the Hound kind of wandering around and the perspective that we get of the peasant class, I guess you could say. Hearing these secondhand stories of stuff that we already know or different point of views from characters talking about people that we're already familiar with. I think that it reminded me a little bit of Arya overhearing these same types of conversations as he was traveling on the road.
It is very reminiscent of Arya and the Hound, except at least initially Brienne doesn't have a companion in the books. Of course, we know that she gets Podrick in the show, but just seeing the fallout from the War of the Five Kings and knowing the level of impact that it has on all different types of people, I think it's very telling that Brienne happens across these two individuals who she can put trust in, and it shows still that times, despite the fact that she is able to align herself with these two individuals for a brief period of time, that this road is not safe to travel. This world in which she lives is one that is not safe. I think the fact that when she initially appears to people and she is on her steed and has her helm down, because of her build, because of her size, she is often mistaken for a man. And I think that that is a means of protection for her that she should use at times to her advantage, again, given the world that she lives in, given the stories that she's recounted, even going back to the camp of Renly Baratheon, never mind the journey she went on with Jaime. I just think that she needs to be very, very careful about what she does when she's in these situations, because none of these people are people that she can truly trust. Trust is something that has to be earned, and even in this series, we've seen earned trust dissipate very, very quickly if it results in gaining the upper hand, whether it is for coin or whether
Sir
it's for power.
Ilfer the Penniless and Creighton Longbow.
Yeah.
They were great.
I think it's funny for me because here's this guy we meet, and he supposedly was pretty badass on the Blackwater. Yeah. Had a lot of success. Killed 12 guys.
When the other guys didn't hear of him, the merchant and Shadrick, they're like, wow, I'm Sir Creighton Longbow.
Yeah. Ooh, I have the honor of being. So it's like, oh, the honor, eh? Yeah, I mean, and ultimately he tells Brienne the story in these all nights she's never heard of. Like, he really could be making all of that up, which is sort of the tiny little bit of pleasure that we can get out of reading this, that there could be this guy who's just really convinced he's an Edge Knight. But isn't, because you never know. These are the people that you meet on the road. And one of the reasons that I love this chapter in general for me, too, is because it underscores how attentive people need to be to their surroundings when they're on this road. Like, ultimately, after the first night, after Brienne's first night with Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer, you know, I think it's Illifer is able to recount sort of this weird piebald horse that came by with this boy on it, and also everybody else that came by in the night when he was watching. Like, they're keeping their eyes out, and they can recall, as can everybody that Brienne asks, you know, ultimately who they've seen recently. It's like they basically, in a world without social media, in a world without pictures, yeah. It's been a while since we've said this on the show, but ultimately their facial recognition is better, and their I guess attention to detail as far as what you see day in, day out is better than ours in our world. Because these are harder times.
Stakes are much higher.
These are times where being able to recognize sigils and being able to infer allegiances as a result of what you're wearing gives you a 100, 200 feet advantage over knowing who the hell it is coming down the road. And this chapter is pretty much all about that sort of behavior of, again, like how Brienne first kind of decides to come to dinner with them. It's just like, here are my needs, here are my dangers, and it's a constant weighing of the two.
Well, thank the gods for Sir Creighton on behalf of Brienne.
Gods for Creighton.
Thank the gods for in the midst of the night when all of those bandits were riding by, and that Creighton was there to show his steel to them, and at one glimpse of his steel, they took off, you know. They
just
were
just like
rough
on the
fellows.
Blackwater.
Mm. Yeah. What is it? What is it? Brienne says, doesn't he say that there's a song? Like, haven't you heard the songs? And she's like,
haven't you heard the song about me? Yeah,
about not how I slayed the knight of the red chicken. Yeah.
He's like, not one that I've heard.
I've heard the about the knight of the red chicken a few times now, and I'm pretty sure it's just I've heard of it every time from Sir Creighton directly.
Yeah. We all know someone like that, right? Like, was there not someone in your life that you were reminded of immediately?
Sir Creighton actually reminds me a bit of Professor Lockhart, or maybe it's the other way around.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. That's good.
But I don't talk about that. Don't these guys sort of strike you as a great duo? They have Sir Creighton to kind of be the comic relief while Illifer sort of remains very stalwart, but at the same time, both of them are a lot stronger and more dangerous than they appear for the sake of the status of traveling safely upon the road. I think if you appear to be poor and of no threat, you're more likely to survive, right?
Yeah.
And despite being these road travelers, I was pretty impressed with how quickly they were able to figure out who Brienne was.
I mean, Illifer says to Brienne, "You bear a liar's shield to which you have no right." Them's fighting words. But ultimately, like, Brienne is none the wiser. And it's kind of, this is a safe space for her to make these kinds of mistakes. But she's going to need to up her game very shortly.
I still think she could have taken either of them.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. Sure. Valyrian steel.
Even without the Valyrian steel.
Yeah.
I think that she's, well, we know that she's very good. She took on Ser Loras Tyrell, and come on, that guy's pretty impressive. He's had the highborn training all of his life in combat. She's not one to be trifled with, so put her with a Valyrian steel sword. Come on. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just bring up this point that made me feel really sad about when she woke up that morning after spending the night with Creighton and Illifer on the side of the road? And she talks about how she can never sleep easy in the presence of men, even when she was in Renly's camp. And the wake up, the first thing she thinks of is, oh, like, nobody tried to, like, molest me in the middle of the night. Yeah. I thought that was horrible. And it just gave me such an insight into what Brienne has dealt with, what we were kind of talking about earlier, what she's dealt with these men in her and people in her life as she's tried to continue to stay true to herself and true to what she wants to do, which is be a knight and be a hero. And she continues to have to deal with this on the side. And I felt that was really sad.
Definitely one of the more depressing realities of the world that we're living in. And this is, you know, Jaime protecting her is one of the reasons why he lost his hand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not to, like, ruin the mood of the conversation. But...
Not kidding. It's fucking crazy.
And I think it's
fucking
cool.
Crazy.
We see in this series women handling themselves in this world very differently, playing to their strengths and all with different outcomes and successful in different ways, which I think we can talk about a little bit with Sansa's chapter. But I think that we're able to see a lot of different perspectives and a lot of strong women without all being the same.
Right. And power and purpose is not gender centric in the story, as it's not really in any story, because that's not how it works. And right. So to see that be stretched across our, like, to go into the past and to know of men and women who have done important things, and to go into the present and to see into the future and see the possibilities of what's to happen, it just clashes with the order, the social status, the social order of the world that they're living in right now. And you can sort of see the progress happening live, and it's what's going on in Dorne, and it's what's happening with their plight. It's just very interesting, and it adds a level of sort of reality to all of the magic that's taking place.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she meets these, or right after the first night, after they've recounted, they hear this chanting in the distance, which Brienne recognizes, and they happen to come upon just a group of traveling sparrows.
George has this uncanny ability to try and slip things past you, even if they should happen to pass you while on the road. And I thought it was very well done that he should introduce us to this band of individuals, and they are led by one high sparrow who we come to know in the television show, makes his way to King's Landing and is going to play a much larger role in the future. And Brienne, who is almost comical in a way, is one of the most pure individuals, comes across a man who is so pious and yet seemingly doesn't want anything to do with him. I think we are constantly reminded throughout the course of the series the importance of religion, and we hear so many terrible things that have happened, and now it is time for those who are responsible to pay the price, to repent or suffer the consequences for what they have done.
Well, gee, I like the seven, but how much do I love him?
Well, you have some coin, we gladly just forget our new friend Brandon and head off.
You are no true knight,
sir. That
was
so funny.
You got to make a living, all right? This is what they do.
This is.
And immediately the sparrows are like flexing their muscles and pulling out their cudgels. They're like, all right, you guys aren't real knights.
Yeah.
You can see right there that they mean business. What up, story set up?
That's true. That's very true.
At one moment they're calling this house the most common and humble of men, and then the next minute they're spitting on these guys, getting kind of
aggressive. We're ready
to fight
for God.
Yeah, they're like, let's go.
When I read this, I thought of the Andals and what they had to have seen before they came to Westeros that made them so into the Seven Gods that they would carve it into their flesh.
Yeah.
They've had to see some shit, right? Think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think that we're not even, like, buckle up. I don't even think that we've gotten there yet.
It says, "These are the bones of holy men, murdered for their faith. They served the Seven even into death. Some starved, some were tortured. Septs have been despoiled. Maidens and mothers raped by godless men and demon worshippers. Even silent sisters have been molested. our mother above cries out in her anguish. It is time for all anointed knights to forsake their worldly masters and defend our holy faith. Come with us to the city, if you love the Seven.
Well, there's no better time for a cleansing of Planetos than after this War of the Five Kings, where people like Fargo Hoat and Dunson and Polymer and Chiswick and all these raging assholes have had free reign to be total lickspittles on the planet. Like, there's no better time for a cleansing than right now. And, oh man, the gods. It's gonna be bad.
One thing that really surprised me, both in the show and it was done in a different way in the books, and it was done through the character of Sir Shadrick of the Shady Glen, a.k.a. Mad Mouse.
Mad Mouse is the mouse from Mouse Hunt, the movie.
He's like, listen, I feel bad for your sister and the knight she's traveling with. I would hate for someone to confuse them with
confuse
the runaway
Sansa and the Dantos Hallard. Yeah.
It's like we were saying earlier, it's good that this happened now, though, and not
further down the line.
Yeah, further, exactly.
And that was demonstrating to her that she was not alone in her quest, that there are other people out there that are looking for Sansa, who are looking to do far more devious things to achieve the goal of finding her, and possibly do even worse things to her once they actually have captured her. And I think it taught her to be a little bit more cautious. I remember in the television show, they went the route of having Podrick try to warn her against Hot Pie, who, let's face it, I mean, what's the worst the kid can possibly do? The
Unless
point
he burns
is,
you.
There are those out there itching at the opportunity. The eunuch has offered a plump bag of gold for this girl you've never heard of. And it was a reality check for Brienne, and I think it was important because it influenced a lot of what she did in the rest of this chapter, right? She's willing to go to the inn. She's willing to take a room. She is smart enough to drink goat's milk. And I think that's important because she knows better. She knows that it's not wise to drink ale, to drink wine in these types of situations.
Maybe she just really likes goat's milk. No, I think that you're right, though, Micah. Yeah.
Bruce Bolton, come on. Right. When something important's happening, just lay off the ale.
You know, whether or not she keeps her company with Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer, she does pay for their rooms. Or their room, it's so interesting how this is sort of simultaneously a passing relationship and yet a fruitful one. Like, there is something that she gets out of being with them. They certainly get something good out of being with her. But, like, ultimately, like, she is, what's the word, generous enough to sort of allow them to accompany her to this inn.
I think that it was very important from a character building standpoint. I know we've talked in this chapter specifically about how there aren't these major events that occur and it's not as action-packed maybe as some of the other chapters that we have read, but you get very strong character development both for Brienne and for Sansa.
She's not committed to traveling completely alone, I guess, at this point, which foreshadows her journey in the future. She's willing to accept the help of others should they have, you know, basically a use for her. And paying for their room is kind of her way of saying thanks, I guess. But ultimately, I mean, she's also not short of change. So
right. Well, Sir Creighton owes the innkeep, what, like 7 stags as it is?
It's just
he rolls in there like, I got this, guys. Like, we can stay here. It's not that big of a deal. And the innkeeper's like, no.
Hannah, you mentioned the connection to Arya and the Hound traveling and learning about folks. And this chapter definitely did that the best. Inside of the inn, when we have direct rumors,
right.
They're talking about Jaime, like he's someone that we don't know, and we're like,
yeah,
we're sort of like Brienne in this chapter. We're like, no, all right, a cohort guy cut off Jaime's hand. All right, it wasn't a wolf that came down.
Be cooler if it was.
That was sort of a.
I love how she can't. She just can't not say anything.
Well, it's like she's out of herself. It says, I think the exact verbiage is she heard herself say. After she tells him what really happened, I'm like, oh, that's kind of a third person way of putting it. Like, she really couldn't help herself to setting the record straight. That also speaks to her naivete. Like, I think she's ultimately going to give herself away the closer, the more she just willingly spurts out information that reveals sort of her identity or where she's been or what she's seen.
Yeah.
It's not a good thing.
Well, in her defense, the hand was lost
Yeah.
You know, and her presence due to him protecting her. I think she felt like she had to speak up for him.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. It was essentially defending Jamie's character. And which somehow no one being, does,
and it's not
fair. Yeah, that's true. So props to her for that. And then also, like, it's just easier. It's better to say, to think that your hand was savaged by this crazy other dude than by a wolf. I don't know.
I do really like what she says about Jamie after she comes to defend him, and she's kind of reminiscing onto their time together about how, I'm just going to read this sentence. It said, Jamie had done many wicked things, but the man could fight. His maiming had been monstrously cruel. If it was one thing to slay a lion, another to hack his paw off and leave him broken and bewildered.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sad that, like, it's true. They could have killed Jamie and whatever, but instead they left him not good at what he was good at before. And I like to get, as we were getting insight on Brienne from Jamie, it's nice to get insight on Jamie from Brienne's perspective.
Yeah.
And how about just the sort of mystery of the North to these folks? How, you know, like, they're living in this area of the kingdom very close to King's Landing. Just, it feels a lot different than those above the Neck. You know, they're able to sort of rumor about a wolf coming down from the North and chewing off the hand of Jamie, which has a lot of imagery, but they, you know, they are saying literally happened. And I'm thinking about the kind of stuff that does happen in the North, and it's like, that's not very far off. There's White Walkers. Mm-hmm. We're so well-traveled. We're like the Three-Eyed Raven, or even better in this sense. And, you know, hearing people's opinions on it, it's just...
Thinking about in the Brienne chapter sort of how she handles and sort of tries to control the information, or actually doesn't control the information, it's such a stark contrast to Baelish, which we see a lot of, who we see a lot of in the Sansa chapter, and seeing how under control his information is and how essential it is that everything out of his mouth is carefully rehearsed and practiced. It shows how far somebody can go. They're like polar opposites, essentially, Brienne and Baelish. But I think it exists for Sansa too, because Sansa is still not at that point where we're more familiar with in the show, like realizing that there's a game to be played. Like, again, she's younger in the book. She's a maid of 10 and 3. But, like, ultimately, this is the first chapter where she's able to, I think she gets her eyes opened,
mm-hmm.
which it's a very important chapter for Sansa.
And I like how it begins with her thinking back to her childhood in Winterfell, because I agree, Eric. I think that this is a big chapter for her growth. And to begin that with her thinking about how she had begged her dad to let this singer stay, and how her days, you know, she loved her days being filled with song. And now it says all her nights were filled with song, and by day she prayed for silence, and how different her life is than it was at Winterfell, and how much she's learning and how much she's changing while continuing to stay true to herself, I think.
To Ned Stark's credit, we all had those songs that we listened to a ton when we were kids, and it drove our parents crazy. Am I right? Like,
and our parents had songs that they listened to that sort of drove us crazy.
Drove their parents crazy. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's that. But for Ned to send the singer away, being like, we've already heard all of his songs.
Well, that was a fair thing for him to do, I think.
I'm like, that was pretty fair. He's sick of this guy.
Did the singer make you think of Mance Rayder at all?
I think it's a different singer. Yeah, I don't know. But I definitely thought of it. I definitely paid lots of attention reading at the beginning of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just like, all right, where are the clues here? The person who came back and sang, maybe that could have
been. Well, we know in one of the John chapters earlier on in the series that Mance has made a trip or two to Winterfell in his day.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I saw this, my initial thought, just like yours, Zach, immediately went to Mance. One of the other things I found really interesting at the onset of this chapter, and I think that Hannah touched on it a little bit, was the contrast between how Sansa used to enjoy music versus how it is affecting her now as she's living her life. It is very, very difficult for her to really get any form of sleep, any clear conscious, and I think it's meant as a means to torture her. And I think that she is living with the fact, knowing that it was Peter Baelish who ultimately killed Lysa Arryn. Meereen had truthfully nothing to do with it, but yet Peter, because of the fact that he is this master manipulator, is able to convince Meereen to be complicit in all of this. the poor young lad has lost his eyes. He's lost some of his fingers, thanks to Mord. And he's just willing to come before Lord Nestor later on in this chapter and admit what he's done. And it just continues to show the influence, the power that somebody like Peter Baelish can have, despite the fact that he really has no physical power. He is all mental.
Well, you know, I just love that as tortured as Sansa is by the music, Robin is like even more tortured.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's just lost his mother.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, yeah.
Where's he going to get his breakfast?
Yeah.
Or, what is he going to eat? Hannah's like, yeah, that's a good point.
Where's he going to get his lunch from now? Oh, God.
How beneficial for Baelish's plan for Sansa, at least, or should I say Elaine, that she was in the process of having her life very seriously threatened when this happened. Because I think this is something that Baelish would have liked to have happened anyway.
I think one of the things that disturbed me most in this chapter was watching Sansa really learn from Peter Baelish and being able to learn how to distinguish between lies and the fact that lies can be sorted out into these different categories. And it's mentioned when they're talking about how some lies are for love, Peter had assured her. She reminded him of that. When we lied to Lord Robert, that was just to spare him, she said. And this lie may spare us, else you and I must leave the Eyrie by the same door Lysa used. So he's teaching her, and she's learning. And I think it is important for her, given her situation, given the house that she represents, that she learn how to play the game. But it worries me that somebody at such a young age is able to be able to distinguish between the different types of lies that you can utilize in order to gain advantage. And to me, that's very systematic. That's very symptomatic.
That moment between her and Lord Nestor when she starts to cry, when she's speaking about what happened, obviously the fake story, and she's crying, and her thought is, that's good. A tear is good.
Yeah. Right?
This is good for her, though. I think that, being under Peter's watch or being like next to him is probably a very safe space to be right now.
I mean, she is his pawn.
She is in the Vale of Arryn right now.
Yeah, but I think that that's a good place for her to be right now. And I also think that these are really good survival 101 skills for her to learn, especially as she continues to be in the position that she is. She's going to have to play the game, as Peter says at the end, but might as well play it smartly. And not to say that his way is quote unquote the smartest way, but it's gotten him this far, and it's gotten...
And even though, I mean, she even observes this, she must be, even before all the creepy father-daughter conversations that happen throughout this chapter, at the beginning of the chapter, she's at least been around him enough to know he's written hundreds of letters, it is said, since the fall of Lady Lysa.
He lost his form of sustenance.
That is, it's sort of the Tywin Lannister way of doing business, right? Letters over, the pen is mightier than the sword sort of thing. But ultimately, he is making those arrangements. She sees him making these arrangements. She sees these birds flying day and night. And that's all a symbol of his calculated planning that are going to basically continue to give him exactly what he needs. Of course, we see it in person. He, you know, talks his way with Lord Nestor very well into the most comfortable space that you could ever imagine that he would be in. But ultimately, like, it's a little bit of both. And he is accomplished enough at doing both of those things. And it really is impressive. He is a very, apart from being creepy, he's a very strong role model for Sansa, and an example of what she's going to need to learn if she wants to survive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for Sansa, this is why she must learn to survive. In the book, it says, only sometimes Sansa found it hard to tell where the man ended and the mask began. Littlefinger and Lord Peter looked so very much alike. She would have fled them both, perhaps, but there was nowhere for her to go. Winterfell was burned and desolate, Bran and Rickon dead and cold, Robb had been betrayed and murdered at the Twins, along with their lady mother, Tyrion had been put to death for killing Joffrey, and if she ever returned to King's Landing, the Queen would have her head as well. The aunt she'd hoped would keep her safe had tried to murder her instead. Her uncle Edmure was a captive of the Freys, while her great-uncle, the Blackfish, was under siege at River Run. I have no place but here, Sansa thought miserably, and no true friend but Peter.
And actually, the line just above that, I thought was so telling. Zach, you just read the paragraph, but her ability to differentiate between Peter and Littlefinger, mm-hmm. I think, is so telling. It shows such a level of intuitiveness. And we mentioned earlier her ability to really adapt to everything. It says he was Peter, her protector, warm and funny and gentle. But he was also Littlefinger, the lord she'd known at King's Landing, smiling shyly and stroking his beard as he whispered in Queen Cersei's ear. And Littlefinger was no friend of hers. When Joff had her beaten, the imp defended her, not Littlefinger. When the mob sought to rape her, the hound carried her to safety, not Littlefinger. When the Lannisters wed her to Tyrion against her will, Sir Garland the Gallant gave her comfort, not Littlefinger. Littlefinger never lifted so much as his little finger for her.
Yeah, and I think that that's also a good lesson for her to learn. Is I'm not worried about her falling down this hole that I think Peter has as he's become Littlefinger, which is to gain power for himself and to kind of put himself at the top of what's happening in Westeros. But I think that she, because she's perceptive enough, as you said, Micah, to understand the difference, that she's only going to be able to use this as a strength to stay alive versus her essentially slipping down the slope of trying to just gain power for herself. At least that's what I see.
Also, Baelish needed to do that because he came from nowhere and is nobody versus Sansa, who is the key to the North just by birth. Like, just her birth status means that she doesn't need to fight for the same things that Baelish is fighting for.
Mm-hmm. I'm worried for Sansa, though.
Yeah.
I'm worried with all of this exposure. She's losing a lot of her own identity. Chapters later in this book are called a totally different name. I'm worried because we see it starting to begin to work now, and this is only the beginning of the process. Think about a friend of hers, Theon Greyjoy, who was captured against his will, and you see right. Sansa not captured against her will, but sort of captured for her will. It's at least set up in the circumstance to where this is a good thing. Taken in, identity stripped away from him, identity stripped away from her, his status as being a key to something, her status as being key to something, his eventual, I guess you could say, downward spiral into being a lackey with complete loyalty to its master.
I think that's a pretty good comparison, but I feel like she's continuing to become more perceptive and smarter and also more compassionate as she continues to learn these things. So I'm not quite as worried about her yet, although you're right. I mean, this is the beginning of this relationship with Peter, really. But I don't worry.
If it were Peter alone, I think I'd be a little less worried. But the fact that Robin's there and he's just lost his mother, and that's a relative of hers, and you know, she feels bad for this kid. At the very end of the chapter, he says, "Are you my mother now?" She's like, "I guess I am."
And again, like especially in this chapter too, I found it so rewarding that we got so much Baelish, but we weren't in his head. I still like that ambiguity there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he completely comes clean to Sansa and is teaching her in this moment, so we don't need to be in his head.
Yeah, we don't need to be in his head almost.
We don't need to be in his head. It would creep us out if we were there. But, you know, like, this is, there's still, like, so many great characters that aren't and maybe, hopefully, even never will be POV characters. But, like, you love seeing these characters interact with them and watching him make his magic. Like, Sansa is sort of a sieve for all of these details. Like, she has her performance, but ultimately, how he manipulates Lord Nestor and what he gives him and how this all comes out at the end, and basically afterwards he's like, "Do you see what happened there?" You know, like, what is it? The line is wonders, what wonders can be worked with a couple of promises and Arbor Gold. It's just he's teaching her, and I think she's picking it up, but ultimately, like, you couldn't have asked for a better example from Baelish here, because this means their life, essentially. Like, everything that he promised the singer that gets Marillion to confess to the crime is all of it is brilliant.
These guys are like eating out of his hand almost when he accuses Marillion, and Aubyn's like, "Yeah, he did this to me, or he said this to me, or blah blah blah." They're loving it.
Mm-hmm.
Peter's like, "Yeah."
I thought
what's
that was
up?
The most impressive part until what happened with Nestor Royce took place. I was like, "Wait a second, he just got completely absolved of what he did because Marillion just completely implicated himself." 100%. I did it. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
And part of it is, again, it goes back to the singing too. Like, Lord Baelish was able to afterwards be like, oh, I feel like I've been too soft on the boy. To be truthful, I pity him. But like letting him sing, letting him let out his emotions led to Marillion himself feeling like he was being treated well. And, you know, kind of going along with agreeing to confess and say what he did. It's all because he was allowed to sing. It's all because he was given that space and told what to do. He trusts Peter.
And Robin reacting negatively to it certainly helped the case.
Agreed, 100%. His Lord Protectorship of the Eyrie, or sorry, of the Vale, is in question, and it's people would seek to root him out. He's constantly having to extend his reach and maintain his foothold in this place. This death, which was, you know, certainly coming, but not expected to come so soon with Lysa, you know, has caused him to think fast, but he's got this. There's almost no moment where you're like, oh man, Peter's in deep shit. Because once you see he's writing all these letters and once you see Marillion confess to the crime midway through the chapter, you're just like, oh no, this is fine. He'll be fine.
He's treating with Nestor Royce. Well, treating is probably not the best word, but he is talking with Nestor Royce about what will now be given to him, something that has stayed in the Arryn family for generations. And now he is willing, through another lie, saying that Lysa had wanted this for Nestor and wanted to give his house, Keepers of the Gates of the Moon. And who knows how this is going to sit with the other families. It's mentioned that some are going to come in force, Simon Templeton, along with Bronze Yon, Lady Wainwood, Lord Belmore, young Lord Hunter, Horton Redfort, Strong Sam Stone, the Tollets, the Shetts, the Coldwaters, some Corbrays. So in this instant, we're getting to learn more about the Houses of the Vale and those that served House Arryn. And we have a sense that some of them are going to be a little bit more suspicious than good old Nestor was. But yet,
he's so happy.
Peter Baelish is aware of all this.
They clang their goblets. What a great move, because if it ever came to swords, and Baelish was so, what's the word? He was just very self-deprecating. He's like, I could never stand up against Bronze Yon and all of the Royces. If they don't want me as Lord Protector, fine. I have like 20 men that I can call. And then yeah. Nestor's like, well, that's basically true. I'll have some of your wine. And then he's like, by the way, I have this parchment with this executive order that says we're not going to give the bottom of this mountain and its castle and all of its lands and its titling and its honor to someone else inside of the family. We're going to give it to you and your family, from now until forever.
He is able to have the foresight so that he can continue forward with his ultimate goal. We were with him in King's Landing, and yet he was able to pull the strings. He was able to manipulate the Starks. He was able to manipulate the Lannisters. He was able to manipulate Lysa, all the way to the point of getting Jon Arryn killed and setting this entire series into motion. Yet here we are again with him, in a completely different location, in a completely different part of Westeros, and he's doing the exact same thing.
It's very fragile, though, this house of lies that he's building on. I hate saying that. He's just building this fragile facade about what's really going on, and one small error and everything can unravel, and it'll be interesting, like you're saying, Micah, to watch play out.
Yeah. And that's why I think the situation with Nestor was so wise, because if it ever did come to something, that brilliant move of putting his signature on the parchment that gave the Gates of the Moon to Nestor Royce was beautiful, because he becomes so crucial in that being upheld. And as a strategic place, the Eyrie is near impregnable, but add the fact that we have an ally on the bottom of the mountain if it ever came to even a slight armed situation.
I love this line from Littlefinger. Men of honor will do things for their children that they would never consider doing for themselves. And speaking about Royce being one of the lesser houses of Royce, and how it just, like, you placate these people, and he knows their motivations. And it's interesting because some of it is like self-insight, for he knows that he was low and wanted to get higher. But he's just got this insight in the world where the whole world is like that. You know, younger brothers want more power than older brothers, but the world's against that. And it's just like he is, I think, using his own story to interpret, and he's had enough experience at this point that he is giving people what they want, and he's sealing these deals and these allegiances that are going to completely benefit him against what is sort of the natural order of things, because he doesn't have any blood ties to the Vale and doesn't really belong there and doesn't have the Vale's best interests at heart at all. He's not doing any of that for the Vale. He's doing it for himself.
I know that it is unorthodox, but I will jump ahead to the chapter that we're currently on, if that makes any sense, and say that Peter Baelish, for escaping persecution, you know that Nestor Royce did not come all the way up the mountain to have a merry conversation with Peter Baelish from the Fingers, who is now Lord Protector of the Vale, right? But it ended in cheersing Arbor Golding.
Yeah. I think Peter's a shoo-in for my own as well, for the Sansa chapter. He just has so many witty liners. For instance, this is Oswell. Sansa says,
"Oswell, God, my lord, get me started on the Kettle Blacks."
"Oswell rode me from King's Landing the night I escaped. He must know I am. If he's half as clever as a sheep pellet, you would think so. But Oswell has been in my service a long time, and Bruin is closed mouth by nature. He has his finger on everyone's pulse, and
yeah,
we almost need the Varys expose chapter to follow, like, to happen right next after this, because it's just like seeing how this man operates and seeing how Varys, again going back to, it was the two of them, they were the people in the background who were really controlling everything, and Varys is at a loss now, you know, having left essentially in self-exile, but like you just, these two men have controlled everything, but we really got to see a lot of Peter in this.
That played into our reading order some, because, you know, in last week's episode, we sort of had that with Varys and what he's up to. And here with Tyrion's wife or whatever, we have Baelish's planning. You know, they're dipping from the same pool.
Before we move on to our own, can I say my favorite part of this chapter?
Yeah.
That I get weirdly excited about every time. This is so dumb. Anytime that Baelish or anyone in the series talks about this being the Game of Thrones, I get weirdly excited about it. And so I just want to draw attention to that at the end of this chapter.
Why the Game of Thrones?
Mm-hmm. There's nothing interesting to say about that other than cool.
When they title drop Game of Thrones in book 6, you're going to be really excited.
I am. I just get more and more excited every time. I don't know why. I just think that that's like cool.
Oh, it is.
It's like, this is the Game of Thrones. Book 4. Like, I love this stuff.
I'm tempted to say this is no game we play, daughter, but of course it is the Game of Thrones.
He looks into the camera.
Seeing as how we've just given two owns for this chapter, is it okay if Hannah and I give our owns for the Sansa chapter first as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My own could be classified as an Eric own.
My favorite.
How's that, Micah?
That
really
means it
curious.
Could be literally anything.
Anything.
Yeah, it could be anything, but it's not. It actually goes to a very craftily...
I can't wait.
...melded... It actually goes to a very fine piece of dentistry for one Mord, his golden teeth paid for.
Yes! Yes! Oh, that was going to be my own! Oh, yes! Mm-hmm. You know that some guys who are prison jailers, who are a little low on the totem pole, would get a bag of coin and decide, maybe I'll see if I can ply a different trade or better myself in some in some abstract way. Mord just goes for the gold teeth.
Do you think that he paid for gold teeth, or he had his gold directly melted down into teeth?
Whatever way is less painful, because Viserys died with melted gold on his person, I would probably say. I don't know, it's hard to say. What does dentistry look like in Westeros?
Probably not great.
He likes his job, all right? He gets to torment people. He's actually quite partial to the Sky Cells, I hear.
You know that song, Grail?
That was a good one.
Call the jewelry store and tell him make me a grail. Okay.
Just give him a call. Just call the jewelry store.
I'm just going to give my own to Sansa in this chapter, because I think that we see, after she has survived in King's Landing as essentially a traitor in the Lannister court, and now she's here under Peter Baelish's watchful eye, she continues to... She hasn't faltered, and I think that we see a lot of other people who have become unhinged by grief and loss, and especially that moment when all these terrible things that have happened to her family are being listed off, and we realize everything she's been through, and she still has her wits about her. So own to her for surviving and thriving ish.
Sometimes it's all you can do.
Yep.
And back to Brienne.
Okay. So we mentioned how special it is getting a Brienne chapter for the first time. It was going to be the next sentence, but I've changed my mind.
Oh, very quickly.
What do you guys think? What's going to happen for Brienne Owens?
It was one thing to slay a lion, another to hack his paw off and leave him broken and bewildered.
I have to get my own to Sir Creighton for bearing steel and scaring off an entire band of would-be ruffians away from their sleeping area. I think that they knew not to mess with him. They heard about how just strong and terrifying he was against the gore-bladed Knight of the Red Chicken. He's like, I don't know who he was, okay? I wasn't sure what was happening, but I didn't know his name.
I really like your Creighton voice.
I think in the audiobooks, he's like, well, I scared me.
That's half of the voices in the audiobook.
That's true. That's true. So, Sir Creighton.
Thank you, Sir Creighton. I'm going to give my own to Sir Shadrick of the Shady Glen, a.k.a. Mad Mouse. Not only, as I mentioned, I was impressed he calls Brienne out on her shit so well, but when Brienne first asks him, who is this Sansa Stark and why do you seek her? His response is for love. For love. Aww. Why else? And she furrows her brow. Love? And he says, aye, love of gold. Like, oh God. For a second, you think he's like totally taken. He saw her an attorney years ago. It's like, no, it's not of that at all. It's love of gold. So he had the most wit, I feel, in this chapter. Mad Mouse, the own is yours.
I'm going to give my own to Renly Baratheon for this moment that Brienne describes about when, I'm just going to read this paragraph, it says, and Renly Baratheon had showed her every courtesy, as if she were a proper maid and pretty. He even danced with her, and in his arms she'd felt graceful, and her feet had floated across the floor. Later others begged a dance of her because of his example. From that day forth, she wanted only to be close to Lord Renly, to serve him and to protect him. Aww. And I really like that moment, especially after we see the types of comments that are constantly made at her, and how her self-esteem kind of is ripped at constantly. And she has this great moment to think about with Renly, where he made her feel graceful and wanted and welcome. So a good man, rest in peace.
Yeah. Now and only now am I seeing what people were on about when they were supporting his claim to the throne. I'm like, oh yeah, he was just a dece. He was just a dece dude.
It's too bad he didn't bend the knee and kneel to the one true king.
Yeah, you know, he kind of just should have waited for Stannis' reign to end.
He's like, no one likes Stannis. I'm running for office.
What is it? That line, dead babies deny it, or women, naked women, or dead men, old men deny it with their dying breaths or something like that.
Yeah.
Your claim. I love it.
And now we open our arms to you, the listeners. What fabulous owns.
We heard via email from Reese Palazzolo, who says in an email to us, hey, Goo Crew, I'm going to be away on holiday for the next week, so I will no doubt miss the next call to arms for Owns. Ooh, he sent his Owns in advance. Here we go. Brienne, Own goes to Sir Creighton for his use of the Cartman defense when called fat, as in, I'm not fat, I'm big boned. For Sansa, my Own goes to Littlefinger and his seemingly bottomless bag of quotes. Quote, we shall serve him lies and arbor gold, and he'll drink them down and ask for more.
Mm. Over on Twitter, Brienne of Tarth says, my Brienne own goes to Bree and her absolute diehard refusal to give up on her quest. For Sansa, her own goes to Littlefinger for playing everyone in the Vale like a xylophone, and to Sansa for keeping up. Brienne also added that an additional loan goes to both my middle fingers thrown up at the people who think Sansa and Brienne chapters are boring.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
I love how we address that. Like, own to us for talking about that earlier.
I think it's
chapter.
Important.
It is important.
Sorry,
it is.
Blackwater can't be in every chapter. Heathen writes in. For Brienne 1, own to Sir Creighton Longbow, who owned the Knight of the Red Chicken at Blackwater. Now he won't shut up about it. Also, Sansa 1 owned Ghost of Baelish, who outright confesses to murder without confessing. If I had not insisted, it was I who killed her.
Yeah. And then we have Jules, who says, Brienne owns to the other knights, as she has more knightly virtues in her little finger than they do between them. And Sansa owns Baelish now that he's teaching them how to lie.
We heard from Joseph Wayne. Brienne own goes to the High Sparrow for making his first appearance. Sansa own goes to Mord for spending Tyrion's gold on teeth.
All of them.
And Momo says Brienne owns all the men she meets by showing class and not kicking all their butts, even though she can. Hashtag Brienne the beauty.
Jerry says, own for Brienne's chapter goes to Brienne's eyes. Through them we see the true cost of the War of Five Kings on the small folk. And own for the Sansa chapter goes to Marillion. He managed to haunt the Eyrie, and he wasn't even dead.
Ooh.
That's spooky. Ooh.
Brad Beeger on Facebook, own for Brienne goes to goats, for a direwolf is rumored to have chewed the Kingslayer's hand off, and we know it was the work of Varga Hote. Nobody suspects the goat. And for Sansa, own goes to little Robert Arryn, ever the opportunist, motorboated the eldest daughter of Eddard Stark in this chapter. Hashtag boats and goats. Thank you, Brad.
Boats and goats. Gotta have me my... Jason Nocera on Facebook writes in, own for Brienne goes to George R. R. Martin for never leaving out the smallest of details in his chapters. Sir Creighton lifted one cheek off the saddle to scratch his arse. I highlighted that. Just we need it in this chapter. Own for Sansa goes, Reginald goes to Littlefinger and his continued mastery of playing the Game of Thrones. Even naive Sansa recognizes it when she thinks to herself, Littlefinger was only a mask he had to wear. Only sometimes Sansa found it hard to tell where the man ended and the mask began. Littlefinger and Lord Peter looked so very much alike. He even acts like a professor of subterfuge when he quizzes Sansa at the end of the chapter as to why he gave Lord Nestor the Gates of the Moon and signed it himself.
Alma Lidman Bring. Brienne owned to all the names, Illifer the Penniless, Shadrick the Mad Mouse, Lord Lucas the Pander, Manfred of the Black Hood, and the Knight of the Red Chicken. I agree. I wish I want to meet all those people. Sansa. I refuse to give the own to Creepy Finger, which makes this difficult.
Yeah.
That's true. My own goes to Mord's new golden teeth, no doubt paid for with Tyrion's money from all the way back in a Game of Thrones. I love a good callback. Well, Alma, we do too.
Mark Mahal says, Brienne, own goes to Sir Cedric the Mad Mouse.
Love it.
For being the only one smart enough to see through Brienne's awful cover story. Also for his awesome nickname. For Sansa, his own goes to Peter Baelish for making everyone around him feel important, when in actuality, they're all just pawns in his scheme.
And lastly on Facebook, Emily Bryce says, Book 4 owns the show. Both of these plot lines are so much more interesting and nuanced. I mean, I love the show, but this book is blowing it out of the water.
It was special. I feel like the show touched on a lot of the sort of overtones that we come to realize in Brienne's storylines when we were maybe overlooking places like Moat Cailin or Dark foresty lanes with Podrick.
Yeah.
Small feelings.
As always, we appreciate the owns that you send in for each and every episode that we do. These did not disappoint. Next week, we are going to see Bran and Arya in two different books. But send in your owns to us. Eric will tell you how to do that.
You can own us any one of those ways we've just read to you. The addresses, the contact info on how to do that is as follows. If you want to email us, contact@gameofowns.com is our email address. On Twitter, we're @gameofowns on Twitter. Just @reply us when we ask for the owns, or send them in advance, as some of our listeners did this week. And on Facebook, scroll upon our wall over at facebook.com/GameOfOwns.
If you subscribe to our podcast, A Squad of Ice and Fire, on patreon.com/goo, we just released a long there's too much in that episode, and we're following it up with a bit of a more ridiculous one that we actually recorded earlier today. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, one other way that you can leave your feedback for the show is on iTunes. It is the month of March now, so nothing less than 5 stars is acceptable. Just head on over to iTunes, leave us a 5-star rate, and review the show. And I know we've said it a number of times on this podcast, but we continue to hear from listeners who have found the show on iTunes for the very first time. And it's because of reviews like yours that they download us and they give us a listen. So your rate and review is extremely important. And of course, if you choose not to rate us 5 stars, you may end up in a sky cell with Mord. And let's face it, despite the gold teeth, you just don't want to have to deal.
And with our most recent endorsement from a one Aaron Trump hair, we are confident to move into the 6th season.
Now this is great, Aaron. We appreciate you writing in. It's a very coincidental time of year. We appreciate
your username
your
is hilarious
to write into us. It's great. It's
no one
wonderful.
Listens to our podcast like you.
You're going to make this podcast great again. Thank you so much for your contribution. You are the show.